Enchanted Sky Media.
This is Code 3, the podcast for firefighters. Now, here's your host, Scott Orr.
That's right, and I will not let Parkinson stop me. Thanks for joining me again this week. It's been 4 years since the Fire Service Brotherhood lost 19 elite wildland firefighters in Yarnell, Arizona. They were the country's first and only municipally based hotshot crew. The Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot Crew was based in Prescott, Arizona, the same town from which this podcast originates. The 20-man unit started in 2002 as a fuels mitigation crew and became hotshots in 2008. On June 28, 2013, lightning started a brush fire, which began burning through and around the town of Yarnell. The Granite Mountain Hotshots were assigned to fight the Yarnell Hill Fire. On June 30th, 19 members of the crew were overrun by the fire and killed. This was their last radio transmission.
Okay, I'm here with Granite Mountain Hotshots. Our escape route has been cut off. We are preparing a deployment site. And we are burning out around ourselves in the brush. And I'll give you a call when we are under the shelters.
Okay, copy that. So you're on the south side of the fire then?
Thanks for arm.
Okay, we're going to bring you the VLAT, okay?
They had deployed their fire shelters, but the shelters were no match for the intense firestorm. The only man to survive, Brendan McDonough, was the lookout, and was moving the crew's vehicles when the rest of the crew was killed. The duty of informing the public of the hotshots' deaths fell to Prescott Fire Chief Dan Fryhoe.
Emotionally?
No.
We're devastated. We just lost 19 of some of the finest people you'll ever meet. I mean, right now, we're in crisis. Truly, we're going through a terrible crisis right now. If you ever met them, you'd meet some of the finest, most dedicated people. These are the guys that'll go out there with 40, 50 pounds of equipment and walk 5 miles. They'll sleep out there as they try to develop fire lines and put protection between homes, natural resources, and still try to remain safe.
Fryhoe was a fire service veteran who had started his career in Phoenix in 1969. But he'd only been the fire chief of Prescott for about a year when the tragedy struck. Today on Code 3, we look back at the aftermath of the death of the Granite Mountain Hotshots with the man who was there, Chief Dan Fryhoe. What were you doing when you got the news about the hotshots? Do you recall?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we were at one of the larger fires that we were dealing with that particular day was on top of the what we call the P Mountain, and the biggest fear we had was that it was going to go over the top of that into the ranch area. And I was with the incident commander there at a lower part of the mountain there when I got a call from Darrell Willis. And at that time, he told me that there was 19 that were our crews were missing. Later on, I got the call that they had found the crews and no one survived.
Now, how did that affect you at the time?
Well, it as soon as he told me that shelters had been deployed, which was on the first call, immediately, I knew and felt the worst. Anytime you deploy a shelter, it is a last resort, and survivability is very limited. So it was a crushing blow, and then the anticipation getting the second call only heightened that fear that I had.
Now, you hadn't been the chief of the department for all that long at the time.
That's correct. I had been hired as an interim, and then months later, then I was offered the job.
So did you know the men at all?
I had met them all, and I knew several of them by sight and by name. It was a young group, and I had met with them on several different occasions, but not to the extent where I knew them all personally. but we knew each other well enough to be able to greet each other, whether we were on the street or on the job.
Tell me about them. What were they like from your point of view?
Well, you know, these were young guys that are energetic, and some of them were recovering from issues that they had found some camaraderie within their group. They recognized teamwork. They started recognizing leadership and things like that. Others were seasoned professionals that had been there before that were excellent mentors to some of these younger guys. Most of them were looking for opportunities to stay in the fire service one way or the other, and hopefully maybe get under some of the larger fire departments in the area. They were good sense of humor. They were always joking. They were always pranking. They were always very happy. They worked hard. Excellent conditioning. They had to. And their leaders and mentors were also in excellent condition, but they knew how to manage people. They knew how to manage the men to the extent where they had a tremendous amount of respect. So overall, I would say that it was a team of 20 people, and within that team, they had strong leadership, good management skills. They took care of their own. They would not allow one of the people to get out of line without the rest of them jumping in there and setting things right. And they had an excellent leader in both Eric and in Darrell Willis.
You made the announcement to the media the night that it was confirmed that they had been killed. But what were your next 2 weeks or so like?
Oh, my God, Scott. I can tell you this, that even though I remember certain details, it was almost like a blur. One of the things that I had to deal with immediately was to talk to the families. And at that particular time, it was at the middle school auditorium. And at that particular time, I had just found out what had happened. And so it was a matter of going and talking to these highly distressed and highly emotionally charged people, and let them know that their sons, relatives, or husbands had all perished. That was one thing. The other part was organizing something of this magnitude. I knew what we had to expect within the city, even when there's one fatality. But the magnitude of 19 fatalities, a tremendous organization had to be put in place. So as I was doing some of those things with the families, I had other people setting up the organization, the incident management system that was going to be required. At that particular time, the mayor was with me when I spoke to the families, and then all of a sudden he just kind of went away, and came to find out later that he did not like the idea that we had brought outside help to assist us, and so then that became a political problem for me, was trying to convince him that something of this magnitude required a tremendous amount of organization and logistics. As we went through the process, then the next day I went to the city manager and told him that this is not a fire department issue. And even though I will do all I can, this is really a city issue and I need their help. He would not help me and the mayor would not help me. So it became pretty much what we were doing as an incident management system, which incidentally is the same incident management system that's taking place all over the country right now, including those big fires that we have in Arizona, or whether they're hurricanes or building collapses or whatever. And it just started getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because the magnitude of the problem was, as we were identifying issues, the logistics of some of those things were just enormous.
Right.
So basically, I was letting the incident management system work. And we appointed people to certain things, and I became the tiebreaker, or the person that would make the final decision on certain things. There was the families to deal with. There was the fire department itself to deal with. The assistance that we had from other fire departments that were coming in on their own to help.
Let's talk about that for a second. There were other fire departments that came up here from the valley to take over.
Yeah, they came in from all over the state. We had them as far south as Nogales, Tucson, all over the state they came in here. And we had volunteers coming in to assist the incident management system, even though they wanted to assist as far as the fire department was concerned.
How much did it help to have those people come up here?
Oh, it was enormous, Scott. It was enormous, because any time something like this happens within an organization that is close-knit, as let's say fire, police, or military and things like that, the impact of people that are close to you, that you know, that you work with, is enormous. and it somewhat paralyzed the organization just in the reaction and the grief to it. And so what we did with those people was basically replace them with outside units, and then we had individuals from our department ride along with them to provide the let's say the mapping or the response. Each engine from whether it was from Phoenix or from Glendale, one of our people was with them, and so they basically started taking care of the area. Now, Central Yavapai played a big part in that time, but they also had people that were involved that had been devastated by it because they were right there with our people. So that was an enormous help. Also, we needed our people to help in the logistical planning as far as the memorial goes and the funeral arrangement and the hearse arrangement. It's mind-boggling to be able to deal with something like that without a very strong organization in place.
And then there was that memorial service in Prescott Valley. It was massive. What do you remember most about that?
Well, I think that was one of my bigger regrets in as far as the city's response. When I asked the city manager for help and didn't get any, and then when I was informing them of what was taking place, I told them that the only place that made any sense at all was the, at the time it was Tim's Toyota Center. They got very upset because it wasn't going to be in Prescott. And I said, there's no venue big enough. I said, you can anticipate 20 to 30,000 people coming in for something like this. They got very upset, and to the point where the mayor started pouting and he wasn't going to go and this and that and the other and stuff like that. But I stuck to my guns, and we noted, we asked the city of the town of Prescott Valley if they would assist, and they were just incredible. Prescott Valley did more than Prescott did to help us. But it was July, the humidity was already high, and we would have had to put jumbotrons in parks all over the city, and also in whatever auditoriums that we could get. We could not get the college auditorium at that time, and I don't remember what the reason was for that. But if you went to that memorial, you saw the magnitude of the planning.
Oh, yeah, there were people outside, even at Tim's Toyota Center. There were thousands inside and thousands outside.
Yeah, and they had things set up in Phoenix. I mean, this was an enormous, enormous national tragedy. You can compare something like this to a slow-moving disaster. In a regular disaster like a flood or something like that, things happen really, really fast. But on something like this, we had a little bit more time for it. But the magnitude of the problem is just as big.
And, you know, with a problem this big comes a lot of news media from around the world, really.
Absolutely.
How did they handle it? Did you think they handled it well, or were they a problem, or where do you stand on that?
I thought they handled it very well. They were very respectful. I, like I am with you right now, would interview any time they called me, whatever it was. When I think it was CBS or one of those, Matt Lauer, whatever that one is, they called me. They asked me if I could be over at, it was over the internet or over, you know, I was at City Hall with the interview, but it was at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it didn't make any difference to me when anybody wanted to talk to me. I would be there. But they were always very respectful. They had media from all over the world. You're absolutely right. I even did some of the interviews were in Spanish for the Univision and some of those stations. But I always feel that this is the type of information that's extremely important. But what happened, Scott, is I became the voice of the incident and the face of the incident, because with no support, everybody was coming to me. And I'll just tell you one real quick story that was...
Sure.
I was doing a CNN interview over at the middle school, and it was over toward the football field. And as I was walking back to the car, my cell phone rings, and it was an unknown caller. But, you know, typically, at that time, I was answering all of them, but I almost didn't answer it. So anyway, when I finally did answer it, he said, "Chief Ryho," I said, "Yes, may I help you?" He says, "This is Joe Biden." And I said, "Oh, my God, Mr. Vice President." You know, I was happy that somebody like that had called. And he said, "Hey, don't do that." He said, "This is just man to man. This is just you and me." He said, I am so sorry for what you're going through. And then he explained some of the issues that he had and how much he appreciates the fire service for what they did for his son and his wife and things like that. And Scott, I got more dialogue from McCain, Flake, the governor of New Mexico, the vice president of the United States, and the mayor and city manager from Phoenix than I did our own people. This is what was really, really painful for me. But anyway, getting back to your, that was an aside, getting back to the media, no, they were very respectful. They asked questions. I was very direct with my answers. If I could answer them, I'd tell them, and if I couldn't, I wouldn't. And I think that they appreciated that. I think most people that saw the interviews appreciated the way it was handled.
Do you feel like at any point there was somebody pointing the finger at you?
I think that for the most part, everybody knew that this was an incident that Prescott was not responsible for, good or bad, that they were away from the city. So I never felt that there was any sense of I'll use the word blame on anything that I may have done. The issue for me to deal with was the totally what I consider immature attitude of the city government to deal with it. From personnel to the mayor's office to the city manager's office, there was a couple of council people that were kind enough to come up and say, "Hey, Dan, how are you doing?" But other than that, it was I felt totally alone through that whole process, and from that, I think there was a lot of hard feelings that were developed because of the way it was handled within the city that eventually led to my demise. But I was never blamed for it. It was never you should have done this or you should have done that, because the system that was in place that had sent these guys all over the United States in the first place was one that had been sanctioned by the city. The city hotshot program itself was the only one in the United States, and that had been set up years before. So it was hard to put blame on anything, but it was just one of those horrible, horrible things that happens sometimes under the worst conditions, and the finger pointing was basically at the state, at the crew leaders and things such as that.
Were you a part of the investigation process?
Only to be interviewed. The investigation process basically was dealing with those things that took place over there. My interview was really somewhat mundane because, like I said, I had nothing to do with the incident itself, and whatever precautions were needed out there, whether they were safety or equipment or otherwise, they were well equipped and well trained. So it was only through interviews.
There's been discussion about the fact that the unit was supposed to get 2 days off for rest, but they were called back up instead. Do you think that played a role in what happened?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It was toward the end of the rest period and things like that. It was close by, and them going over there. You know, here's what I think happened, Scott, based on the best information I've gotten, is that they were on their way to a safety area, which was a ranch. You probably heard that part about it. They were on their way to a safety area, and during their journey in that direction, the storm that hit here in Prescott that day, and that day we had, I think, 3 structure calls and 4 wildland fires here in town. And when that front came through here, you know, those fronts are, I mean, that's not a front. Those down drafts are omnidirectional. That's what probably changed fire another 90 degrees, and then they were trapped. And there's all kinds of speculation. Why didn't they go to the black? Why didn't they do this and this and this? Which we'll never really know. However, the guy that was in charge, Eric Marsh, was excellent. And if he decided that they should stay there, then it was probably the best information they could have gotten at the time. But it was, you know, it's just one of those things that happens. And I think that with the second wind shift that came to them, they just had no place to go.
Now, this may be hard to answer, but I want to explore for a moment the public reaction. At first, the public was 100% behind everything everybody did with this incident. But it seems like as time went on and they filed lawsuits, that goodwill sort of wore out, and eventually people became frustrated with the hotshot families. Did you see that?
I think there's a lot of truth. truth in that, but I think that there's a very realistic reason for it. First of all, when the families all came together, you can only imagine what they were going through. And as things started to settle down a little bit, you know, basically, what's the next step? Now we've got everything else going on with the memorial, and all those things are being taken care of by the fire department. But the city has to play a role somewhere down the road. And so when they would go talk to the mayor's office or the city manager's office or the personnel office to try to get answers, they got the cold shoulder. I tried to get the mayor to meet with the families, and my point was, look, meet with them, let them diffuse some of the anger, and then start talking about whatever options might be possible. He refused to do it, and so they had no place to go. And so I think that had there been a little bit more compassion and understanding about what they were going through, and a little bit less of the officiousness that was taking place by the city, that things could have been very different.
You've been pretty hard on the city during this interview, and I'm kind of curious if you have a feeling for why the city officials reacted the way they did.
You know, that part I don't know for sure. I don't know if they feared lawsuits or whatever. I can't be sure because I wasn't privy to those conversations. Toward the end, the city pretty much stopped talking. I say the city, the upper levels of the city pretty much stopped talking to me. And so I was kind of left out of most things that were taking place. And all I was doing was getting information from the families and people like that. And like I said, that's why I tried to get the city to at least meet with them, listen to them, find out, you know, what their feelings are, diffuse some of those things, and look for options if there are any options. So I don't know if it was the legalese that got into the way of potential lawsuits if you say too much and this and that and the other. But I think that a lot of that could have been eliminated with sitting down and talking to them. There was a refusal. I even told the mayor at one point, like, I said, listen, you know, the families are talking to me. They're listening to me. I'll be there with you. And he said, nope. He says, and that was it. No, he just said, nope, and walked away. So that's why I think some of the things started happening. So as the emotions started escalating, and then pretty soon there was, and they started lawyering up, and then pretty soon there was television reporters there on the plaza, and you know, the widows of the firefighters are, you know, saying what they were saying. It just became one of those things, well, these people are pretty greedy because there's a lot of donations coming in, and where's the money going? And it really became kind of a frenzy. And they don't deserve anything. And you know, there's a lot of people that were very upset with the families and with the wives and things like that. But they, without the understanding that there was a reason. These people wanted to talk to somebody, and I couldn't give them any answers. So that's what my sense is. That's what I've always contended, that there could have been a little bit more communication taking place.
So how do you feel about the decision not to rebuild the Granite Mountain Hotshot team?
Well, it was a good concept at the time, and it was revenue neutral, and it provided a lot of extra protection in the summertime when they were in the area, and in the wintertime they were used for other things. I don't know that a city type wildland team is necessary, and not because of liability and things like that. It's just that they were used much more outside of the city than they were within the city. However, when I was here, when I was the chief, we had a fire up in a part of the city up toward the highlands and through there, and it was an evening fire, and it had gotten into the brush, and those guys happened to be there, and we saved a lot of property by the fact that we had them here. But it's a good concept. It's great to have it. I don't know that we should have another one, but I think they did a lot of good. They were revenue neutral, and most of the time, and other times they brought in more money than it was costing. But the price that was paid and the notoriety that happened after the incident, I think it would be very difficult for any city to assume the liabilities that go with something like that.
There was a lot of speculation and digging around by the news media, especially magazines that had more time and space to work with, and they all had their own conclusions. Have you seen any of those, and did you find them to be reasonable?
I think most of them were stretching to make a point. The conspiracy theorists came out in force, and I was very public about one of them. I don't remember his name. I think Doherty was his name. He was saying some outrageous things, and I went public on that particular one. But it was a conspiracy theory. It's the same thing that you're hearing now, you know, unspecified sources or anonymous sources or here's the logical conclusion based on this, and this. And so, yeah, there was a lot of that was going on. And, I mean, even within a year or so ago, some of that was still happening, that they were drunk, they were partying, that they didn't have enough rest, and it goes on and on and on. But I still have confidence that the people that were in charge knew what they were doing, and they were doing things for the right reason with bad results.
Did this incident directly lead to your leaving the city?
Well, I think so. Because...
Well, let me stop you for a second. For those people who aren't familiar, you said that you were forced out. They said that you resigned.
I was seeing it being at odds with what the city manager and the mayor wanted. And my explanations only seemed to exacerbate their desire to be in control but not be involved. They wanted to change things and do things without literally getting involved with the management system. I'll give you an example. The day that I talked to the city manager, the next morning, I met with him in his office, and I said, Craig, I said, this is not a fire department problem. This is a city problem, and the city has got to become more involved. They said, well, we don't like the idea that you got a bunch of people coming in from out of town, this and that and the other. I said, well, look, I said, if you want to make changes, the incident management site is in the basement. Just walk downstairs and tell these guys what you want. Well, I'm not going to do that. I don't like the management system and this and that. And the other. I said, Craig, I said, you don't know what you're talking about. I said, the incident management system is one of the most important management tools for any kind of a disaster. I said, and basically, you're dealing with a disaster here. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll think about it. That was it. As time went on and the memorial ended and things like that, then it became a matter of finances, you know. There were some finances that were going to be involved. I couldn't get any answers. Even since one of the guys to our finance director at the time, and, you know, I wanted to find out what kind of options we have for some of the expenses that were incurred. And his response is with what Philly says, you're screwed.
Oh,
something
that's
like that.
Helpful.
And so, yeah. So anyway, as time went on, then I started getting less and less communication from the city manager's office. And so at one point, I finally set up a meeting for him. I said, hey, Craig, I said, what's it going to take to communicate? I said, for some reason, it doesn't seem like you want to communicate. And I'm known as a communicator. And he said, well, quite frankly, I want you to re-retire. I said, okay, I'm coming in here to set up a communication line with you, and you want me to leave. He says, yeah. He says, there's some changes that are taking place, and we would like somebody else, blah, 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 and stuff like that. I said, okay, I told you that I would leave. Anytime you wanted me to leave, it will not be an issue with me. I said, but this is your idea, not mine. What I should have done is said, well, just fire me. Have the guts to fire me. I wish I would have said that, but I didn't. Because even the contract that I made with the city, I added the very last point number 6 or 7, whatever it was, that by the city's choice or by my choice, I could leave anytime I wanted to. But I came out of retirement to do this. You know, I'd been gone for 9 years from the fire service and several years from emergency communications in San Francisco. So when they asked me to come to the city, they needed help. They needed help with the fire department. There was a lot of issues that were taking place. And the secret to helping the fire department was sit down and listen to those guys. In a month, things changed considerably. But anyway, that's another story. Getting back to that part, then he wanted me to leave. I said, okay, if you want me to leave, I'll be gone. But it's your idea, not mine. And that's how I ended up leaving. So the deputy city manager was in there with us. And she never said anything, and I should have looked at her and said, do you agree with this, just for the drill? But I didn't. I walked away. I sent an email to the personnel director. I said, I've been asked to leave, and what is the process, or something to that extent. Later, it came out when they found out that I was leaving, then they asked the city manager, what the heck's going on? He said, well, it was a mutual decision. It was not a mutual decision. I was a thorn in their side because I was a little bit too independent for that style of leadership, and it was more expedient to get rid of me. So we never use the word fired, but when I joke about it, I say, yeah, I was fired.
I wonder what you think of now when you think back to your career having ended this way instead of on a happy note.
I always, through my entire career, I always put the service delivery first. That was number one, always. Above politics, above anything else, service delivery. Secondly, was supporting the people that provide that service, supporting them without having to be influenced by union and political problems or anything else. It was supporting the people with safety, with training, and those sorts of things. That's always been my priority. Political considerations was third, and that was only if it supported the first two. So I feel very comfortable with that. Philosophical approach to service delivery. It's always about the customer on their worst day is when we should be having our best day. And so I look back on that, and I'm very comfortable with that. In reality, that cost me the job in Santa Barbara County. Now, that was a different one. That was a different way to get rid of me. But basically what they did is they reorganized the fire department, and they put the sheriff as the fire chief. They wanted me to make some major cuts, and I would not do it. You know, my thing is that if you want major cuts, make them. But don't try to make it my idea, and then you sit back and deal with it. Well, it was a fire chief's decision. I told the same thing to the mayor and to Lamerson one day. We were outside, and they were lamenting the idea that the fire department goes on EMS calls. And I said, Mayor, I said, you know, if you have the political will, all you have to do is say, don't go on EMS calls anymore. That's the simplest solution there is. Well, I'm not afraid to make decisions. I said, well, no, I'm saying you're afraid to make decisions. I'm simply saying, if you don't want the fire department to do something, say so. Never went anywhere, obviously. But that's the way I feel, you know. It's easy from a political point of view to try to influence somebody to do something, and then you can sit back and weigh your options on how to respond to it. And my options were always to be in for public for service delivery and good customer service. When I was here this is an aside, when I was here in Prescott, I had a young firefighter do something really stupid. And I met with senior staff, and we talked about it, and, oh, well, you know, he's at this and that. And I said, no, I said, he's gone. He's fired. And they were appalled that I would fire anybody. And I said, no. I said, that's it. But by the same token, if somebody did something well, I was the first one there. I never missed a fire anywhere in this city or anywhere the fire department responded that was or a major EMS incident. But that's an aside. Now I'm just bragging.
So how do you think the men reacted to how you reacted to the deaths?
Scott, I've never been with a fire department that was more supportive during my leadership there, after my termination, and even now. I can walk anywhere in this city, and if those guys see me, they come up and they greet me. They're sincere. They're they understood. They understood, and that's all you can ask for sometimes.
All right, Chief Dan Fryo, thanks for being with me on Code 3 this week.
It's always a pleasure, Scott.
If you want to know more about the Granite Mountain Hotshots, there are photos and information on our website, so go to code3podcast.com. While you're there, you'll also find links to a couple of books on the Hotshots, and if you order them from Amazon through our website, you're helping to keep us producing this podcast also. And we're also selling very nice Code 3 t-shirts on the site. They're $20 and they also support our podcasting efforts. So order one or two or three and show them off. They're very nice firefighter worthy t-shirts, and so you'll be helping us while you increase your wardrobe. Alright, that's all for this week. I'm Scott Orr. I hope I'll see you again next week.
Code 3 is a production of Enchanted Sky Media. To get in contact with us, visit code3podcast.com. And if you haven't subscribed yet, you should. Don't miss an episode. Find us at the Apple iTunes Store, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.